Latitude Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk about foraging for wild mushrooms and how to make some delicious dishes out of them on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, on April 11th, Dante Wright, a black man, was shot and killed by a white police officer near Minneapolis during a traffic stop. The police chief of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, who has since resigned, said the officer pulled Wright over for driving with expired tags, then found that he had an outstanding warrant. Kim Potter, the officer who shot Wright, said that Wright resisted arrest, that she accidentally fired her gun instead of her taser. Potter has also since resigned. Among other issues, Wright's death has raised concerns about traffic stops themselves and whether there are racial disparities in determining who gets stopped and, when they do, if the stop leads to background checks and or car searches. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Data does show racial disparities in police traffic stops. Have you had the experience of driving while black yourself? If so, we want to hear from you. Or do you have questions about research on traffic stops and who gets pulled over and searched? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Kelsey Schaub is an assistant professor of political science at the University of South Carolina, Columbia, and co-author of the book Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race. Kelsey, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on the show.
Before we get into what you found in your research, Kelsey, I want to sort out a couple of different types of traffic stops that I think you distinguish pretty carefully between. There's a police observe somebody driving unsafely or speeding or something like that. And then there's the other kind of sort of an investigative, looking for trouble kind of stop. Can you sort those out for us?
Yeah. So there are hundreds and hundreds of reasons that any of us may be pulled over by the cops on any given day when we're driving down the street. Essentially, if someone wants to pull us over, or if a cop wants to pull us over, there's likely something we are doing in how we're driving that can facilitate that. However, when we're doing research on this, my co-authors and I and others tend to divide those like broad, very minute details into two different broad categories. One, as you already said, are these safety stops. So we do know that some folks are on the road driving unsafely. We want to increase that road safety. So like if someone's going like 65 in a 20 zone, they should probably get pulled over, get a ticket, get told to slow down because that might cause a crash. They might hit people that are crossing the street because what's going on in those zones is different. On the other side of things, though, are these investigatory or pretextual stops. So those are things that we categorize as reasons that you may be stopped, where underlying that is actually the intent to get a look inside of your car, stop you for a conversation to kind of suss out whether there should be a further investigation. And things that we categorize as more in line with that is something like expired tags, as in the Wright case, or some sort of vehicle code violation rather than the safety stops where it's like you're speeding, it's drunk driving or something like that.
So let's take this to your research now. You're there in South Carolina. Your neighbors to the north in North Carolina had a law that required them to collect data, including the race of people pulled over by police. As you started, you and your colleagues started to look at that data, what kind of things were you looking for?
Yeah, so when we started looking at the data, which is essentially every police department in North Carolina, be it the state police, sheriff's departments, or essentially anyone, any municipal to police department of a reasonable size has to collect, we were primarily first looking at who was searched and looking at the racial disparities and who was being searched. And why we were doing that is it's actually pretty difficult to figure out like who is on the roadways to figure out those disparities and who are being stopped in a statistical manner, I mean. So we started off by looking at who searched, and what we found is what I think a lot of folks now considering the conversations that have been going on, especially since last summer, is that Black folks are more likely to be searched following a traffic stop. And that actually increases that like disparity increases between Black and white drivers if you're pulled over for those investigatory or pretextual reasons rather than those safety reasons. Beyond that, what we found is that men, for example, are more likely to be searched than women. Younger folks are more likely to be searched than older folks. And using some data from other states, such as Illinois, we've also seen that folks that are driving essentially like older or potentially like worse looking cars, or in, that are more like more likely to be in disrepair are also more likely to be pulled over and stopped or and searched.
One explanation I've seen offered, including by police agencies, I think in the past is, hey, we're looking at higher crime neighborhoods or people who meet certain profiles that make them more likely that we're going to find something when we search them. When you look into the results of these searches, how does that argument stack up?
Yeah, so we've looked at this at a bunch of different ways. The two key ones, as it relates to your question, are first on the like alternative explanations we've done. Some other work that essentially tries to control for or account for as many of these different explanations as possible, such as the crime rates for the areas, the like diversity of the area. So one of the other explanations is essentially like if you look out of place in a neighborhood, the cops are going to stop and question you to make sure that you actually belong. So like if you control for those things, the race of the driver still is associated with how likely you are to be searched. So essentially in those cases, we still see Black drivers are more likely to be searched than white drivers. To the second point on the, well, they might just be carrying more contraband on them. They like certain populations might be more criminal is how it's sometimes phrased. To look at that, we've looked at who's actually found with contraband following those searches. And what we found is on average, actually, that Black drivers, at least in our North Carolina data, are found with contraband less often than white drivers are. So one interpretation of those results is that they're actually essentially over-policing the Black population and under-policing the white population.
We are talking to Kelsey Schaub from the University of South Carolina, Columbia, co-author of the book Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race. And we're looking at traffic stops in particular. Kelsey, so what do you take home after looking at this as to the cause of these racial disparities you found in searches?
So there are two general causes that I would say the research points to in this case. I mean, it's a little difficult to disentangle the two. And one are implicit biases, which have also been talked about a bit, especially since this past summer, where essentially all of us out there in the world have these biases that are ingrained within us, essentially by society, that the media, our daily interactions and all that kind of condition us to have these shortcuts, these heuristics that we use in low information environments, such as in a traffic stop when an officer might not have full information about like what the driver's doing, what their intentions are and all that. And one of the sets of those implicit biases that most of us have are that we're gonna view especially young Black men and Black folks more generally is more suspicious. And as a result, in terms of policing, what that means is that those folks are going to get pulled over more often. They're going to be searched more often and just see essentially more negative outcomes, more surveillance by the cops. The other is that there's something more systematic going on that agencies are making decisions that are either intentionally or unintentionally targeting these communities. One way to essentially combat both of those things, though, is through various types of policy changes that can either limit the discretion of officers on the ground or essentially rein in some of those disparities across the different neighborhoods. Such as, for example, one reform that people have instituted in various forms is looking at consent searches. So if you're pulled over, there are a couple of different ways you might get searched One is a probable cause search. So that'd be like you have contraband lying out in your car. For example, like you might have like a beer cracked in the front seat. Your car may reek of marijuana or something like that, which you're not supposed to be doing when you're driving. And so then the officer would have probable cause to search your car. The other form is a consent search where an officer can pull you over, ask if they can search you, the passengers, or the car, and then you have to give them explicit consent for a search to occur at that point. It is fully within your rights to say no. A lot of people do not, because the power dynamics in such a situation are such that like saying no might not feel like an actual option at that point in time. So in some places, what they've done is either ban those consent searches, which is what the state of Connecticut has done starting in October 2020, or shifted over to like a written consent form where all of that is explicitly laid out. And in both of, at least for the written consent form, what we've seen is like that decreases the number of searches and it decreases, essentially benefits both white and black drivers as a result.
We're talking to Kelsey Schaub, assistant professor of political science at the University of South Carolina, Columbia, author, co-author of the book Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race. We're looking at racial disparities in traffic stops and ensuing searches. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on this idea of investigatory or pretextual traffic stops? That is, stopping someone, the police stopping someone, not because of a specific safety violation, but to look for evidence of a crime. Do you think police have too much leeway to pull people over, or do you think it's a valuable tool? Have you been pulled over for a bad reason, do you think? If you work in law enforcement and you've made traffic stops, love to hear your perspective on this as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with University of South Carolina political scientist Kelsey Schaub. She analyzed 14 years worth of traffic stops and found consistent racial and gender disparities in how police conduct traffic stops and who gets searched further after that stop. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic, maybe your questions or your own experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Kelsey, what do we know about the benefits of these investigatory stops? Are these stops finding lots of crime evidence?
The short answer is no. So what ends up happening with these stops is that a small proportion of people get searched, be it from these investigatory stops or via like more safety stops. When they do search the cars, they often don't find anything. Sometimes they do. And when they do, what they find is usually like very small amounts of contraband. So it might be like a smoked joint is in the car or a can of beer is open. It's not like they're finding huge catches of contraband. That being said, there are occasions where they do find this, do find these huge catches of drugs. However, what we've seen a couple times, at least in North Carolina, is some of that evidence actually gets thrown out because of the nature, investigatory nature, either of the stop or based off of the stop patterns of a given officer. So for example, there have been a couple of cases in North Carolina where evidence has gotten thrown out because whoever stopped the car, the officer who had stopped the car, had actually only been stopping and searching Latino drivers rather than actually either not really searching people or stopping and searching a variety of people. So again, short answer, not a huge benefit to them.
Now, I know this is a little outside of your research, I think, and this might be something that is hard to research given maybe the lack of data out there. But a big concern, obviously, is when these stops lead to violence, either a police-involved shooting or violence committed by the person pulled over themselves. Do we know how common either of those events are?
So I, unfortunately, do not have hard numbers for North Carolina, how often those occur following a stop. Partially that is because we chose not to really dig into that because they are recorded as happening so infrequently, even among 20 million stops. More generally, it's actually a pretty hard thing to study because there aren't really like nationalized databases yet cataloging these uses of force incidents or cataloging police shootings more generally.
Now, you were able to study North Carolina because of a law in that state recording this data. How common is it for states to do that and to really watch these traffic stops and have that racial breakdown to where you could even start to study the racial breakdown of stops?
Yeah, so it seems like it's been an increasingly common type of law that state legislatures have passed, often in response to some sort of like driving while black or in the essentially our current period, like a BLM kind of protest wave going on. So the other state that also has pretty long running statewide data that's at the individual level, like North Carolina, is the state of Illinois. And so we see similar patterns from North Carolina in that Illinois data, which to us tells us that at least what we were identifying in North Carolina means that like these racial disparities aren't a Southern problem, which I think in today's America, from what's going on from video evidence, people have stopped really trying to argue. Beyond that, other states like Connecticut, Maryland, I think California recently started making public their data, have been passing these laws, starting like racial justice task forces, or at least just investigations into whether and to what extent there might be disparities or like over-policing going on. A great example of that is Connecticut, which also actually formed like a unit that actually analyzed all of that data. And then over this past summer, they pushed through some emergency legislation that actually implemented some of the things that they flagged as problems previously.
So, as we wrap up, Kelsey, what was the response to your study in North Carolina? Did anybody work to make changes based on the evidence you provided?
I would say the response was mixed. So some of how we even like got some of the information for the book were steered to look at some of the specific policies we looked at, such as the written consent form, is because we actually did go out and talk with and to some of these agencies, and specifically those that had already kind of gone through a period of turmoil with their local population, such as the Fayetteville Police Department, and they were then in the midst of or repairing those bonds, were actually like pretty excited to talk to us, because we ended up doing some analysis that showed like some of the things they were doing were actually working, and that it wasn't negatively affecting any sort of like arrest rate. And in turn, when they like actually publicly implemented that written consent switch from a verbal consent to a written consent for those types of searches, you actually saw more calls for service. So people actually calling in and asking for the police to come and help them or to give them information. The rate of those went up after that.
And we'll leave it there. Kelsey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kelsey Schaub, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of South Carolina, Columbia, co-author of the book Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race. Time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a listener's question about a neighboring state.
One of the most popular questions we've received from listeners through the Wisconsin Project relates to our neighbors in Michigan. Many of you have wondered, what's the deal with the Upper Peninsula? Why is it a part of Michigan and not Wisconsin? We sent Laura Pavin to the UP last football season to find out more.
Think about it. Wisconsin? It shares more than 200 miles of border with the UP. Michigan's Upper Peninsula is connected to its Lower Peninsula by a bridge. And yet, the UP's part of Michigan. But why? Well, it was never Wisconsin's for the taking. In the late 18th century, Michigan and Ohio got in a tiff over a small piece of land called the Toledo Strip. They fought over it until Congress stepped in and proposed a compromise. The territory of Michigan could become a state if it gave this strip of land to the state of Ohio. In return, Michigan would get all of the Upper Peninsula. Eventually, Michigan took the deal. Wisconsin had only just become a territory at this point. So, here's an interesting thought experiment. Should the UP have gone to Wisconsin? Would it have made more sense geographically and culturally? To find the answer, I drove to the UP border towns of Marinette, Wisconsin, and Menominee, Michigan, and hung out with people at the bars during a football game. Because if you want to see where people's allegiances lie, you might as well take a look at what team they root for. And, drumroll please, the team of choice for Menominee residents I talked with was...
Packers.
Packers fan?
More of a Packer fan.
I hate the Lions. Hey, can I say that? I hate the Lions.
But why the Packers? Well, Green Bay's close to the UP. Plus, Packers games are broadcast on local TV. Beyond football, Wisconsinites and Youpers also seem to share a bit of an accent.
Yeah, hey, don't you know? You betcha.
We say, oh. Oh, some people say we sound like Canadians.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Linguistics experts say that Wisconsin and the UP definitely share key features, like the long O, saying dem, dare, and doze. And some Youpers and Wisconsinites share this thing called Canadian raising, which is basically where you say things like a boot instead of about. So, 2 points for Wisconsin, 0 for Michigan. Finally, there seems to be a deeper tension between the UP and their southern counterpart. Here's Kylie Sundstrom. She's lived in Menominee her whole life.
I think we just need to be separated. People all leave like the UP off of things, like maps and stuff.
More than a decade ago, a tourism commercial sponsored by the state of Michigan left the UP off, showed only the mitten. It actually led to legislation requiring that any official state publication show the state of Michigan in its entirety. So, Youpers feel like they're left out of stuff. Some actually tried to make the UP its own state. All of this made me ponder, do you need to be physically connected by more than just a bridge to feel like you're truly part of the same state? I asked Mary Antoine, a historian with the Prairie du Chien Historical Society.
In Wisconsin itself, there is an east-west. Living here in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, we feel that the whole eastern side of the state doesn't even know that we exist. That Wisconsin economy is totally focused on the greater Madison area and the Lake Michigan area from Chicago to Green Bay.
Culturally and geographically, Wisconsin and the UP look like they belong together. But continuous landmass or not, it seems like distance itself is the great divide here. That's something every state has to grapple with, including Wisconsin.
WPR producer Laura Pavin brought us that story. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And today is Laura Pavin's last day here at WPR, though she's not moving to the UP. Sorry, UP. Laura, it's been great working with you. Best of luck in your new job and your new home. Coming up after the news, it's almost the season to forage for morels, the wild mushrooms that have such big fans in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a chef about preparing them. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up Monday at 7 on the morning show, it's the State Capitol Report. Check out the latest news from the governor and the state legislature with WPR state government reporter Laurel White. That's Monday at 7 on the morning show. Now, there are lots of wild mushrooms in the Midwest landscape, and morel season is a pretty big deal here in Wisconsin. Some call Wisconsin the morel capital of America, with generations of families searching for them every spring. Why? Because they're tasty. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest shares advice on foraging for morels and other edible wild mushrooms and how to cook them. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you forage for morels? Are you looking forward to the season? Most likely, what, mid to late next month? Is this a tradition in your family? Do you have a trick to hunting them? Do you want to share your secret spot? Probably not. And how do you like to eat them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alan Burgo is a chef in Minnesota who hunts for and cooks with wild mushrooms. He runs the website Forager Chef, which is focused on seasonal cooking, preservation, and culinary experimentation. He's got a book coming out soon called The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, recipes and techniques for edible plants from garden, field, and forest. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you've got a lot of fellow morel fans out there, I assume, Alan, but for the uninitiated, can you tell us why you love foraging for morels and other wild mushrooms?
Well, I mean, for me, it's kind of like a giant Easter egg hunt, and morels are one of the most exciting to find. It's, you know, we've been cooped up the whole winter, and it's really great to be able to go outside, and it's, I mean, it's kind of like Christmas. Like each one is like finding money laying on the ground too. You know, it's really exciting. I think that's probably the biggest thing for me. It's a rush. I mean, it's a sport. In Europe, it's almost a sport.
Yeah. Well, and like most sports, there's a chance of losing. I've been in a couple of ill-fated morale expeditions where we came back empty-handed in my life. Is that part of the fun? You might or might not be successful this time around?
I mean, absolutely. It wouldn't be exciting if there wasn't a chance to lose. So you got to figure out ways to hedge your bet.
Now, I want to get some safety stuff in here. What do we want to do for the first time, especially before we go looking for wild mushrooms of any sort, to make sure we're getting the edible ones, not the other ones?
Yeah, it's good to have a field guides can be helpful. Your online community, there's very helpful Facebook groups, your local mycological society. You want to use a combination of things. The best thing that you can do is take someone out with you that knows, that is from your area. That's one of the best ways to make sure. But you do want to know that you're eating. You can identify what you're going to eat with certainty.
Now let's start eating them. Tell us a little bit about what the best ways to cook morels and what they're going to taste like when we eat them.
Well, morels, you know, there's not really another mushroom like them. They have a really rich, meaty, umami flavor. They're not bitter. They have a really nice texture. Like some wild mushrooms, like slippery jacks, they're kind of slippery and slimy. Morels are just this wonderful, light flavor. They can get really big and meaty, big enough to stuff. They dry well, so they're super versatile. And they're just one of the most delicious mushrooms around. I mean, dried morels are really expensive, too. They could go as high as $200, $300 a pound. Dried. I mean, that's a lot of mushrooms, but
yeah, mushrooms are light. That's a nice thing. Yeah. Now, can we? I know with like the button mushrooms I buy in the store, I can cut those up and eat them raw in salads. Is that something I can do with morels?
The morels are fascinating because I'm from Minnesota, and morels the state mushroom, and they're delicious. They're edible. They're also toxic, and that only applies to them really if they're raw or if they are potentially undercooked. So you do always want to make sure that you cook your morels thoroughly.
We are talking on Food Friday about morels, and we'll maybe look at some other wild mushrooms, how to find them and how to cook them. Alan Burgo is with us, a chef in Minnesota. You can find him at the website Forager Chef, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions or you want to share your own experiences gathering morels and other mushrooms and how you like to eat them. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Prairie du Chien. Kay, hello.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What's your story, Kay?
Okay. When I was younger, I used to... Oh, thank you for taking my call. I used to live in the country, and I would go mushroom hunting when it was like just a light sprinkle and damp. But what I would do is I would pull my socks up over the bottom of my pant legs, and then I would tie around the top of that. Then I would tie my sleeves at the wrist, and I would tighten up my collar. And I always wore a hat with my hair stuffed up on it, a tight hat. And I very seldom ever caught very many woodchucks. Of course, there wasn't as many then as there is now, because it's been years ago. But I would get so many mushrooms. I mean, I crawl through the berry briars, single mother with two children. And I would clean them up, and I used to get bags of them. And I had a big freezer. What I used to do is take them home, clean them real well, cut them in half lengthways, and lay them on sheets, cookie sheets, layer them in my freezer. And then when they were froze, I tap them and I put them all in one big bag. And that was, of course, I had to give the fresh ones away, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were so good because you could, when they were still froze, you'd give them a good wrap. Sometimes they'd break up. And then you could put them in, like, with your roasts, with your stews, with anything. And you know, your chicken noodle soup or whatever. I mean, anything.
Okay, thank you so much. Kay, very careful about ticks when she used to go hunting for them. But she also brings up something I'd wanted to ask you about, Alan, preserving. If we do hit the mother load of morels, how do we preserve them? Kay would freeze them. What do you think? Is that the best way to preserve them?
Well, sometimes freezer space can be at a premium. So what I usually do is I put mine in a dehydrator. And they're, like I said, one of the best things about morels is that you can dry them and then rehydrate them and cook them. And when you fry some of those in butter, you could probably fool some morel hunters into thinking that they're fresh. Mm. They really dry well. And drying them also means that you'll swish them in water to kind of rehydrate them. And that is also kind of an extra step of cleaning them because, I mean, these are wild mushrooms that did real wild mushroom things. You know, they get all kinds of stuff on them. And it helps make sure you don't get any grit with the mushrooms.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, you shared a couple of recipes with us. We've got them at wpr.org/Food Friday. We've got links up there. This one, I love this because it combines the morels with another one of my favorite springtime pieces of produce here, a morel and ramp spaghetti. Tell us about this dish.
So the morel and ramp spaghetti that's from one of my old chefs that I used to work with. His name is Andy Lilja, and he is very talented, and we still will get together. I just saw him a couple weeks ago to hunt morels every year, my old chef and I. And that's another thing. It's a great way to have a yearly tradition with your friends to go outside. It's really great, you know, in a world where we all live on our phones and stuff like that. It's good to still connect in person. But this was a recipe that Andy sent me, and he's like, oh, man, this was so good. I had to write it down right away and send it to you. So you take some ramps and morels, and you work them into pasta with a good amount of butter and a little bit of anchovy and some fresh parsley and Parmesan cheese, and it is just excellent. You can even garnish it with lilac flowers because you can eat lilac flowers too.
Cool. You can find that recipe linked at wpr.org/Food Friday. Let's bring out another caller now. Tim is with us in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Tim?
Well, I still go opening trout season from the western part of the state and where I grew up. And we go out and we try to have trout for breakfast if you know, it's a good year. And then groups go out. One group will go looking for morels and another group will go looking for asparagus. And then we've in the last 10 years or so, we've made asparagus and morel and mozzarella cheese pizzas. So that's a little different.
Nice.
Yeah.
That sounds great, Tim. Invite me along next time. That sounds really good. Yeah, morels on a pizza, combining it with the wild asparagus. So a nice foraged pizza there. What do you think, Alan?
Yeah, that's good. You just want to make sure to cook the morels thoroughly before you put them on the pizza.
Oh, okay. That's a good idea. Now, one of my favorite, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. One of my favorite ways to cook morels that other people have provided for me or that I've bought, Alan, is just sauteing them for a while in butter and a little salt and pepper. Like they don't necessarily need anything fancy, right?
That is absolutely right. And my girlfriend would say that is the only way that she should be served morels. She does not she just wants them simple, fried in butter with salt and pepper, and that's it. And that's perfectly fine.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Alan Burgo, a Minnesota chef who hunts for and cooks with wild mushrooms. He runs the website Forager Chef, where he focuses on seasonal cooking, preservation, and culinary experimentation. Talk to him about foraging for mushrooms and how to whip up a delicious dish with them. He stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a mushroom foraging story to share with us? What's your favorite way to eat morels or other wild mushrooms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about how to spot and cook wild mushrooms as morel season is about to ramp up here in Wisconsin. Alan Burgo is with us, a chef in Minnesota who hunts for and cooks with wild mushrooms. You can find a lot of information from him, including recipes, at the website Forager Chef. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Roger in Madison. Roger, hi.
Good evening. Good afternoon. It's a very wonderful mushroom. I've been hunting them since I was a teenager, and I'm 72. And last year, I found pretty close to 40 pounds of mushrooms. Wow. And I cook them, like the lady said, in butter, salt, and pepper. They don't need anything else. You don't need to try to make them fancy. They're fancy enough. And I find a lot of them by dead elm trees or old apple orchards.
Ooh, Roger, thanks for that tip. And wow, 40 pounds, that's a lot of morel mushrooms. Alan, do you have things like that that you watch for, like Roger's dead elms or apple orchards, that might make you think, okay, this is where the morels are going to be?
So there's a lot of different things that you can kind of look for. Elms are one thing, dead and dying elms, and there's kind of a specific way that the bark starts to shed off. Like, you don't want the elms too dead. You want to kind of sloughing its bark. But morels, more than like a specific tree like that, I like to describe it to people. Well, one thing that can be helpful is to say, I'm looking for disturbances, because that's one of the ways that morels function, is disturbances. In Europe, people used to set fire to their forests because they knew the next year the morels would come. So burns can be a great place to look for morels. Places that have been logged. A great quick story is we just had some, I'm right by Menominee up in northwest Wisconsin, and there was some land logged at the farm that I'm at. There's not a lot of morels there, but I had an inkling there might be some morels after it was logged. A year after it was logged, I found one mushroom. Last year, I went to the same place and I found about 70 mushrooms.
Wow.
And so that's another example of what you can do, because hunting around elms, there's also a lot of competition. You can also find morels with aspens, and there's actually a specific type. It's different from the grays and blondes, are actually the same type of morel. We'd probably call those Morkella americana. And then you have Morkella septentrionalis, which is a black morel up in northern Minnesota. That's probably going to start coming out of the ground in, I would say, less than a week. So that's almost 3 weeks before we might expect the golden blonde morels. But those grow with aspen trees and living aspen trees, not dead like with the dead elms. So there's different things that you can do to kind of hedge your bet. But disturbed areas, even areas that flood, could be another example. Or they could just randomly come up in a wood chip pile. But this year, I'll be looking in logged areas because I have some on private property, and that is, there's nothing better than that, because you know no one's been in your spot.
Roger, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Russ now in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 74, but in my mid-20s, my friend's uncle, who knew all about mushrooms, used to take us mushroom hunting, and we would get lots of button-type mushrooms. But occasionally, we would find one of these huge white mushrooms that must have been, could have been 10, 12 inches in diameter. And I think he called those a bohemian term of klebitch. And we would split one of them, if that's all we found, and cut it up and fry it in butter and garlic powder. And they were excellent. And my other question is, in my local paper, they are advertising morel mushroom kits for about $40 that you can plant in your backyard, and it comes with compost as guaranteed to give you morels for years. Is that really a reality?
No, that's not.
Russ, thanks for the call. Yeah, so why not? So we can't. It seems like cheating, but also, yeah, if it was that easy, everybody'd be doing it, I imagine, Alan.
I have heard of some places that maybe supplied a restaurant or two, but in the mycological world, at least everyone that I know, and I know a decent amount of people in the mycological world, they all just make fun at the Morel kits. It's kind of like a snake oil salesman. I would love to buy a Morel kit, but they're usually just a waste of time.
Now, Russ also mentioned this big, wide, white mushroom he had. Does that ring a bell for you, Alan?
Yeah, well, I mean, that could be any number of things. I would guess that he was talking about a puffball, because those can be very large and white, and you might split one, like, down the center. But there are lots of big – there can be a lot of big white mushrooms. Puffballs are probably the most common, talking about big white mushrooms. And those can be very, very good.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. It's Food Friday, talking to Minnesota chef Alan Burgo. He runs the website Forager Chef, looking at morels and other wild mushrooms. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi. Are you there, John? Oh, no, we lost John. That's okay, because I wanted Alan to ask you about another recipe you shared with us, crab-stuffed morels. Tell us what goes into this one, please.
So this is cool because you can make it with either dried or fresh morels. Morels have – one of the best things about them is their shape. It is just this beautiful shape with the honeycomb pattern, and it's begging to be stuffed. So a little stuffing made of crab meat, some breadcrumbs, a little bit of parsley, some garlic, a few scrapes of lemon zest. You stuff that into the morels, and then you cover them with a little bit of breadcrumbs and butter, and you bake them. And that is one of the best things that I have eaten. They love to be stuffed, and crab meat makes a really good stuffing. It's an easy home run.
Got a link at WPR.org/Food Friday to that recipe. Alan, I know we're talking about mushrooms, and you like mushrooms. They're not the only thing, I think, that you like to forage. What else is on your foraging calendar for spring and early summer?
Well, I'm going to be harvesting wild leeks from the farm. I'm going to be harvesting a lot of different, mostly I eat wild greens, probably a lot more wild greens by volume and poundage than mushrooms. Nettles, there will be sochan, watercress, dame's rocket, chickweed, Virginia waterleaf, all kinds of things. And then the next mushroom that'll come up, or right around the morels, will be the dryad saddle too, or the pheasant back. And those are a great mushroom to get to know because they're really easy to identify, and they're a lot easier to find than morels, so you don't have to go home empty-handed. And those like to grow near dead elms too.
In just our last minute or so, Alan, for people who haven't ever foraged for food, can you just share some of the joy of finding these things in the wild and then cooking with them and eating them?
Oh, come again?
What do you enjoy about being able to forage for wild foods? Just share that enthusiasm with the people who have never done it.
Well, I mean, it is some of the most delicious things I can find. And as a chef, I'm obsessed with high-quality ingredients. That's all I wanted when I was running my restaurants. That's what I was taught, you know, my whole life in the culinary industry, is how important, you know, perfect ingredients are. And ingredients will never be more perfect than, you know, like the moment after you pluck them right from the ground and brought them right into the kitchen to throw them in a pan. It just doesn't get better, any better than that.
Fantastic.
And you get to be outside.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alan Burgo is a chef in Minnesota who hunts for and cooks with wild mushrooms and other foraged food. You can find more at the website Forager Chef, and his upcoming book is called The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, Recipes and Techniques for Edible Plants from Garden, Field, and Forest. You can find a couple of his recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if that's not enough wild mushroom talk for you, the Larry Mueller Show covered some ground with world-renowned expert Thomas Volk earlier this week. You can find a link to that show in our program note at our website, WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the pandemic shook up a lot of people's retirement plans, leading some to leave the job world earlier than they planned and forcing others to stay longer. An expert on retirement finance joins the show, and you could share your experiences. And Green Bay, more like Green Bee. We'll find out why Green Bay is recognized as a bee-friendly city. That's Monday on Central Time. Do you ever wake up in the morning feeling groggy and dull-witted? Or is that just me? Well, some new research might help. According to a study published in the Journal of Sleep Disorders and Therapy, a happy song might work better than your standard alarm clock sound. In the research, people got a special app that played a variety of wake-up sounds from your normal alarm clock to melodic music. Then the app gave them a quick mental alertness test. Now, the people who woke up with catchy songs did better than people who woke up with the alarm sound, and they reported less of a feeling of sleep inertia. So switching your alarm clock from a beep to a song could help. But the researchers missed an opportunity. What if you woke up to a lively conversation with an intelligent host, knowledgeable guests, and curious callers? Well, you could try that experiment on your own. Set your clock, radio, or phone to wake you up to the morning show with Kate Archer Kent this Monday. And back when I worked on early morning shows here on the Ideas Network, I woke up to the beep, beep, beep alarm sound. And it's one that's commonly used for some reason in like advertisements and on TV shows. And every time I hear it on one of those, I have a flashback to diving out of bed to shut the alarm off and get ready for my very early working day. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.